You're listening to Trending with Timory. National speaker Timory Millington has been a passionate advocate for life as long as she can remember, helping Gen X through Z answer the call to true feminism and authentic manhood. They cover the week's hottest stories from a Catholic worldview. You're listening to Trending with Timory.
Welcome back, friends. I am in studio today with a good old friend here, Carlo Broussard from Catholic Answers. He's a Catholic apologist. He has his recent book, Prepare the Way, which we're going to talk a little bit about later on in the show as well. But welcome. Thanks for being here, Carlo.
Hey, Timory. Thanks for having me.
I'm really excited about the lineup we have coming up. And actually, you're here for two episodes. On the next episode, we're going to be talking about some controversial transgender issues, which you were a little shaken by what you saw on the Good Morning show. Good Morning America show.
That's right. Yep. We're going to talk about that. And I think I have a few things to share about that.
So that's a teaser for the other episode of Trending that Carlo will be on this week, which you can find at radiotrending.com or on your Catholic radio network. What I want to talk about coming up here today is we're seeing that there's been a decline in children being born in Italy, and the government's wanting to get involved to make people have more babies. And it makes us ask questions such as, you know, if you have a child, or maybe you're, you know, a young adult today searching for a spouse, will you be able to find a spouse? India and places like China are facing major demographic crises, especially in China. They're going to have tons of millions more men than women who cannot find spouses by the year 2020. I think it was somewhere around 30 million men,
wow,
spouseless men. And so Italy is kind of foreseeing that this is getting pretty bad. We're not replacing ourselves. So we're going to be talking about that coming up. Among other things, we'll also be discussing on the show surrogacy. And what do we think about wombs for rent? It's something that is kind of becoming somewhat normal, and we're not talking about it. As opposed to Europe, and one of Brett Kavanaugh's accusers has come out and said, I made it all up. It's not true. She was angry. We'll talk about that and share our thoughts. But Carlo, I want to start. You can find my guest Carlo Broussard at carlobroussard.com. We'll be tweeting out links to him as well. But Italy has taken a vested interest in young couples having babies now.
And that's something that we can recognize as a good thing.
Absolutely.
It is a great thing to highly value of children and to propagate the human species. It's fundamental to who and what we are as human beings. It's fundamental to our human sexuality. And it's fundamental to society that to reproduce ourselves, to have children, is a common good. It is a good for society and something that society should be interested in, and that government should create certain protocol to encourage,
right,
begetting children.
Now, this is becoming a trend, actually, worldwide, where you saw just a couple months ago that Hungary has changed its family policy as well to encourage young people to marry, to have families. And just in the last 7 years, between 2010 and 2017, they've studied and they've seen that there is basically a third of abortions being performed in their country now in just a seven-year gap. They've seen that marriages have gone up, divorce has gone down, and we're not talking small numbers. And so I think that this attempt in Italy is really going to make a difference here. So what they're discussing in the Italian government is essentially they're going to give you free land if you have a third child. And not only that, they're also going to offer you 0% interest on loans that the equivalent of the American dollar are almost worth $230,000. And so they're really saying, here, let's help set you up so that you have a home. You have a friendly economic makeup where you can really thrive and create a family and love them and be present in their lives.
Right. Yeah, creating a safe environment and a helpful environment to foster the family life and the growth of the family. And once again, as I said, this is something that is a good thing for those in power to be invested in and to order societal life in a way that helps foster the achievement of the good of children. That's what governmental power is all about. That's what law is for. The very purpose of law and those in power is to help human beings achieve the ends that nature directs them toward. This is getting back to classical natural law stuff, right? Because those things that nature inherently directs us to, propagation of the human species being one of them, and having children, contributes to the flourishing of the human being, the flourishing of humanity. And the purpose of law and those in government are to order life, societal life, in such a way that makes it possible for human beings to achieve those things that by nature will be perfective of their human nature, will constitute authentic human flourishing, given the kinds of things that we are, namely human beings.
Yeah. And when we talk about human flourishing, we're talking about freedom at the heart of this. And I think it's very different from our American understanding of freedom and such a strong ideology that I can do whatever I want and it doesn't matter how it impacts someone else. But the real understanding of freedom is the freedom to do the good, right?
That is correct.
To stand for something, not necessarily stand against something. It's a positive definition, not a negative definition. Right. And, you know, I look at what Hungary's doing and how they actually establish their family policy, their new family policy, off of much of St. John Paul the Great's work in Veritatis Splendor, among other areas. And it's refocusing, and, you know, we are actually recording this on Election Day, November 6th, and, you know, people are running out to the polls, and it offers opportunity to discuss for a moment here, like, what is the role of government? And that is to uphold the human person and their ability to live freely in the correct way.
Yeah, moral philosophers distinguish between freedom of indifference and freedom of excellence. The great thinker Servius Pincares was very keen on this, and this is also found in the writings of St. Thomas Aquinas as well. Freedom of indifference, being able to choose A or B, that's an element of freedom. But within the philosophical tradition, even dating back all the way to Aristotle, freedom is primarily understood in the ability to achieve excellence as a human being. So, like, for example, Kent Timmery, I can't play the guitar really well, right? So I'm free to learn how to play or not to learn how to play, right? But I'm not free to play the guitar well because I don't have the skill of playing the guitar. So I'm not free to play it in an excellent way. So the idea of freedom for excellence, you have to have the skill and to be well-trained in doing something, to have the freedom to play all sorts of different songs on the guitar or the piano. I'm very limited in what I can do on the piano. So I'm not free to play whatever comes on the radio or to play some beautiful piece, right? And so concerning our nature as human beings and what and who we are as human beings, we have to develop the skill of being human. But that first presupposes, what is a human being, right? What are we made for? Where did we come from? These ultimate questions of life. Once we get that in, once we get those questions answered and we know what a human being is and we know what's the proper activity of a human being to act in accord with reason, to reason well, right? To act in accord with what we know to be true and to be what is real and to live in an excellent way, what Aristotle and Thomas Aquinas called virtue, right? To live in accord with what is good for us as human beings, then we are truly free to live the excellent human life. To live life as we are called to live as human beings and experience that true, authentic human goodness, which will bring about human flourishing. Of course, that's from the philosophical perspective. Then Jesus comes and reveals with divine light that we are called to something even higher, namely self-sacrificial love in and through and with God in order to achieve an ultimate destiny of a supernatural end, union with God in the Trinitarian life of heaven.
I love as you talk about this idea of freedom of excellence versus freedom of
indifference,
right? And it's fundamental to who we are as people, but I think part of the challenge on an individual level is this lack of self-reflection and self-discernment. You know, you can look at a lot of people and say, who are you? You know, what do you stand for?
Right.
And a lot of people immediately at face value in that questions are stumped at first when you
right.
ask this, or they might cling to a political ideology or maybe some sort of sexual orientation today, unfortunately,
right.
Or more common than not, they identify themselves based on their career. what they do rather than an identity based on who they are. And so as we're talking about this, looking at what's happening in Italy, it really opens a door to say, you know what, this is actually a good policy that's opened the door for people to discover, not just to have babies. And, you know, some people say, oh, they just want women barefoot in the kitchen and, you know, men working in society. That's actually not the case. And I understand that there may be some challenges in the economic inequality taking place in Italy. I see some of this is what people are talking about. But a lot of what they're seeing, if we come down to it, is that demographers are focusing on the fact that this is a real crisis in their country. They see an aging population. They have more old people, essentially, than younger people replacing the communities. Right. And we're seeing, again, the lowest birth rate in Europe is actually in Italy. And it makes us kind of turn back and say, like, why does this matter to us? Because God calls us to be fruitful and multiply. Right. And this is a fundamental part of it. It's one of the first commandments that God actually gives us as people. There's something about that. It's the fact that having children, looking out to people other than ourselves, transforms who we are before God and draws us closer to Him.
Beautiful. Yeah, that's an excellent insight. And not only is it a matter of divine revelation, but what we have there is God revealing something that we can know by the natural light of human reason. When Thomas Aquinas, in his section on the natural law in the Summa Theologiae, when he talks about the good and these natural inclinations, he has the three categories. Those inclinations we share with vegetative beings, right? And plants, right? The self-preservation, the category of inclinations of reproducing ourselves, propagation of the human species, and then the highest category of inclinations, the inclination to truth and to goodness.
That's Carlo Broussard. We'll be right back on Trending. We're going to talk a little bit about your promising music career that you actually left.
Timory will be right back. Tweet them at Timory. That's T-I-M-M-E-R-I-E. You're listening to Trending with Timory, where morality and culture meet, offering an eternal perspective on today's hottest topics.
Carlo Broussard is in the hot seat here. He's actually dancing along to our theme music.
That's kind of catchy theme music right there. It's kind of cutesy, right?
Yeah, it's an old, we're thinking, you know, back to the 1950s and earlier, simpler times,
Amen, I got it.
Yes. So speaking of music, really quickly, we're talking about human freedom, and we're going to be discussing how young Americans are bucking the divorce trend, good or bad. We'll talk about that. But you yourself, talking about freedom, or even, you know, the idea of commitment, whether it's marriage or something else, you yourself had a very promising music career.
Yes, in Southern Louisiana, growing up from the time I was 13 to 20, I was pursuing a Cajun music career, right? Playing Cajun music. I played the Cajun accordion. And if you don't know what that is, just go to CarloBroussard.com, search in Blast from the Past, and I have a few audio clips you can listen to. But I was pursuing that because in Southern Louisiana, there's a market for that. And I was trying to make that a full-time career.
You make it sound like that is so foreign to Californians, but it is.
It is. Yeah, it's like, what? What are you talking about? I actually have videos of this stuff as well. I just haven't digitized it yet. I need to put it in digital form and share it on social media. But yeah, so I was pursuing that, Timory, and I gave all of that up. I cut two albums, one when I was 13, one when I was 16, and I was scheduled to cut my third album when I was like 20, January sometime. 2001, I think it was. And I called the project off. I had some of the best musicians in Southern Louisiana ready to take me to the top, you know, and sort of do this thing all over the country and the world and promote the Cajun culture and thing. And I called it off because I wanted to pursue my newfound dream to be a Catholic apologist, right? Because I had heard the conversion story of Tim Staples 2 years prior to that. Sort of the pilot light lit within my heart, an infusion of divine grace to pursue apologetics. So I gave up the whole musical career in order to pursue my career in theology and philosophy and apologetics. And so here I am, like 18 years later, you know, living the dream. You know, it's sort of a fairy tale story. And I would always tell Tim, I'm going to work with you one day, man. And he would tell me, yeah, I got your back, bro. You know, we'll work together one day. So here we are.
Well, isn't this such a reality of conversion in the Christian life, that we suddenly have this understanding that It's not the kingdom of me, myself, and I, right. and how famous I can be, but it's the kingdom of God. And sure. it's present here on earth. That's what Jesus came to reveal. And that transforms our lives. And sometimes that calls us to give up good and great things that we love
for
and are good at.
For something greater.
For
right?
something greater. Yeah.
Well, fundamentally, I came to a crossroads in my life because I had fell in love with the Lord. I'd fell in love with my faith. I was convicted in the faith, and I was trying to be a man of God and pursue heaven. But many of the environments in which I was playing music in, the nightclubs and stuff, was just not a place for a man of God. And so I was experiencing a major contradiction between what I was learning, what I was preaching at the youth retreats, you know, and I was firing teens up, you know. And on the Friday and Saturday nights when I was in the bars and the nightclubs and what I was some of the music I was playing was impure, you know, the lyrics and stuff, and promoting impure actions and stuff like that. So I, you know, the Lord convicted me in that. I was being hypocritical, and so I chose the Lord rather than mammon.
And that's such an example of so many of us are living in two different worlds. We separate out our faith in one box, our sex lives in another, yeah. our family lives in another, and then our work life, our work friends, you know, we break it up. But the reality is that we're an integrated human person, and our faith influences our family, which influences our work. And so many people, I think the question that we always have to ask ourselves are kind of, where are we living two separate lives?
Right.
Where are, you know, I was talking to someone recently and they work in the hospitality industry and, you know, they're doing a lot, you know, serving and that is not a faith-friendly, family-friendly environment. Or right. I was talking to someone not too long ago who was working in Silicon Valley and just a tendency towards drugs and the lifestyle that they live and the anti-marriage philosophy
right.
they have. And so it makes each of us question, maybe we're not in this drastic two-world type of experience, but is there anywhere in our own life where we're separating out faith, family, friends?
Yeah, that faith has to permeate every aspect of our life. And even if, you know, you discern and it's reasonable to not be, you know, the annoying Christian who's like, Jesus, 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 you know, everybody like, psychology 101, the wall goes up. It's your faith that's going to enlighten your mind to be able to discern when and how to navigate through the waters of secular culture in a way that you don't compromise your faith, you're confident in your faith, but in a way that's attractive to other people and you're not some annoying jerk or something, you know?
Let's talk about this for a second, because we have a trend in the United States of the nuns, as people know, people
right.
who I don't identify with any religion. I think these are the same people who we're seeing statistically are really bucking the divorce trend. They're either not getting married to begin with, or they're getting married much later in life. We talked about this a couple weeks ago on the show, Carlo, with Father Tim Grumbach, and how essentially it's almost like marriage is becoming for the elite, the people who both spouses have a career, they're both very well educated, they're getting closer to their 30s just before or after, and it's like it's become an elitist mentality about marriage, but they are seeming to stay together in those marriages. But the reality is that in general, young people have this attitude that just marriage isn't necessary anymore.
Right. Yeah. Well, what was interesting in the article that you shared, you know, why young Americans are bucking the divorce trends, there are some kernels of truth in there that I think are worth highlighting. So like, for example, there was one story of Helena and Kelly, right? Now, granted, this was a same-sex couple union, a same-sex union. But notice the kernel of truth. They stayed in there, a long-term relationship. You're still not sure, not ready to make that final commitment, right? Mm-hmm. But notice that's we can recognize that's true in what she's saying. I mean, granted, she's misapplying that truth in her same-sex union, we would argue. But at the same time, she is correct in saying that in these long-term relationships of cohabitation, for example, mm-hmm. you're always leaving the room to get out of Dodge when things don't work out right,
yes.
right? And so there is, and so she even perceived that there was this wiggle room, this lack of final commitment, and they still have the inclination, the awareness that when they say I do, the deal is sealed, right? It's sort of a final commitment. And that testifies to the harm that cohabitating couples can bring upon themselves in establishing their relationship. Because if there's always that possibility to say, well, I'm going to get out of Dodge if you don't make me happy, well, then that's not a total self-gift of love. There's no final commitment there. So you lack fidelity because it implies, well, I can just go and be with somebody else. It lacks permanency. You know, the idea that, well, I'm not with you until death do us part. I can just, you know, get out of Dodge whenever I'm not happy anymore. And those two, the lack of exclusivity and the lack of permanency, are the two very things that strike at the very heart of romantic marital love. And so even in this marred understanding of marriage, right, there is still this kernel of truth in saying, well, we actually do recognize this is a final commitment of things. And without that marriage, and she even goes on to talk about the importance of ceremony, right? And right. The idea of bodily signs that signify certain realities. I mean, she's talking Thomistic terms there, because Aquinas talks about this in the Summa Theologiae within reference to the good of rituals, right? As a body-soul composite.
See, she understands in her body, in a sense, that what she's looking for is a sacrament, something transform her, which ultimately the sacrament of marriage is God's way of bringing us about to salvation. Now, Grant, we are talking about, kind of a unique couple here.
Right.
We're not in any way condoning, but we're saying that what people are looking for, what they're longing for,
it's a testament of the deepest longings of the human heart,
right,
for total love, right? Permanent love, love that is everlasting, love that will not fail, full commitment. And this is a testimony of that deepest desire of the human heart, and how miserable life can be if you live in such a way that runs contrary to those deepest desires.
It's interesting. Another one of the couples in this BBC article, I'll be sure to tweet it out. You can find it at Timory. When I tweeted out, really take a look, read through some of this. But one of the couples talked about how really there's absolutely no difference between living together and marriage, except for one thing. And they said that thing was a feeling. Now, it's interesting that they say that. In the next episode, we're actually going to be talking a lot about sentimentalism. But I think that feeling is a feeling of knowing this person's actually committed to me and they're not going anywhere, versus what you said of I always have an out.
That's right. If you know, if I know that the person I'm with has this capability to just pick up and leave whenever, that's a constant fear. I mean, that's going to cause psychological disorders. That's going to cause some unhappiness and misery, because you're in constant fear of this person leaving. Whereas if you know, you have good reason to believe, when this person said I do until death do us part, you have every good reason to believe that this person meant it, right? And they're not like maliciously lying or something. That's going to create a good feeling, a feeling of relief, to be able to relax and a sigh of relief and know, as you mentioned, I can trust this individual. And unless you first have that trust, you cannot move forward in deeper forms of love within a relationship. If you don't have the trust, you literally don't have a relationship. So why would we put ourselves in a situation where we have this constant fear of losing the other and a lack of trust of the other?
A lot of these couples are shacking up instead of getting married. In one sentence, why shouldn't they move in together?
I, as a philosopher, would argue that the answer to that question has to be governed by whether or not sexual activity outside of marriage is actually good for us as human beings or bad for us. And once you answer that question, then you can answer the subsequent question.
Timory will be right back. Tweet them at Timory. That's T-I-M-M-E-R-I-E. You're listening to Trending with Timory.
Might your son be accused of rape down the line? And will someone be justified in claiming it because their feelings were hurt? They were angry. We're going to talk a little later in the show about Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh and how one of his accusers came out saying it was all made up. So Carlo Broussard is with me in studio today. And we left on the topic of one sentence, why shouldn't a couple cohabitate?
And you gave me literally like 15 seconds to answer that question.
I did say one sentence, Carlo.
There you go. Yeah, fundamentally, you know, when I approach the issue of cohabitation, when we all approach it, you can't answer the question of the morality of cohabitation unless you first answer the prior question of whether sexual activity outside of marriage is good for us as human beings or bad for us as human beings, morally right or morally wrong. Mm-hmm. So if we answer that question and say it is morally wrong to engage in sexual activity outside of marriage, granted, we have to substantiate that, but just for argument's sake, given that framework of human sexuality. Well, then when we look at the issue of cohabitation, we have to ask, okay, within this cohabitation, chances are modern couples who cohabitate are engaging in sexual activity outside of marriage, right? Fornication. Well, that's wrong, okay? So they should not be engaging in such activity if they love one another, because it's a violation of love. Now, granted,
it's
of course...
It's lying with your body. It's saying, I love you, but I'm not willing to make a total commitment to you, which means that I can't actually be one with you.
That's right. And it basically says, well, you know what? I don't want to commit my life to you for the rest of my life, but yet I will engage in such activity that's supposed to express that. So you actually rob the sexual act of the very power to express the lifelong commitment and love that it's meant to express. Mm-hmm. Now, granted, we would have to argue all of that, right? But for argument's sake. But let's say, well, we're just cohabitating because, you know, my girlfriend needs a place to live, but we're abstaining from sexual relationship. Okay. Now, that's a different question, right? Because there's a few aspects of that. I could hypothetically see in some extraordinary circumstance where this poor gal just has nothing to do, right? I mean, just nowhere to go. She's going to be on the street. I mean, there's nothing intrinsically wrong with a male and a female living under the same roof, right? And if the gal needs a place to live, I could hypothetically see in extraordinary circumstances that it would be morally permissible because there's nothing
temporary,
but also temporary, right? Not permanent. Very good point that it would be morally permissible in that circumstance. But we don't normally call that cohabitation, right? What we normally refer to as cohabitation is, yeah, you're kind of doing the husband and wife thing. Maybe in this case, they're barring sexual activity, but they're living as everything else as husband and wife. So first of all, you're kind of playing house and husband and wife when you're not, which is flawed and unreasonable. But secondly, given our presupposition that sexual activity outside of marriage, fornication, is morally wrong, like it's immoral and not good for us as human beings, well, to be living under the same roof with a person you're passionately in love with, right? And you have a desire for sexual intercourse and to express that sort of affection with the person, well, then you're putting yourself in an occasion. We would call it as Christians a near occasion of sin. But if I were just talking to a secular person, I'd say you'd be putting yourself in an occasion to where you could possibly end up engaging in activity that violates the love you want to express to your beloved.
When we're talking about putting yourself in a near occasion of sin, that is first and foremost what matters. And we don't talk about this enough. Like, sex outside of marriage is a sin. And
that's right.
It's placing our souls in jeopardy. It's making it so that we begin to justify one thing after another. And I think because I like talking about cohabitation with our next topic, surrogacy, because when we take sex outside of marriage, we take babies outside of sex, suddenly who suffers? It's the children. Right.
Amen.
First and foremost. And we're going to talk about that. But remember, too, when we're talking about cohabitation, you have that theological, philosophical dimension that is so real and so potently destructive in the human person. You also have the fact that you're opening up yourself and maybe any young dependents to physical, sexual, even emotional abuse, but especially sexual and physical abuse. If you're maybe you have a kid and you're moving in with someone else, it's very, very high numbers that those children end up being sexually assaulted.
Hmm.
We could talk about the fact that young people who are cohabitating are actually leaving themselves vulnerable to physical and sexual abuse.
Right.
In those circumstances, a lot of these people are shacking up and they haven't even been together, let's say, more than a couple months or a year, right?
Yeah, I have a friend of mine that lives within close proximity to my home in our neighborhood. And his girlfriend had moved in.
Mm.
And he literally was saying, we'll see how long this lasts.
Oh.
And I was like, Man, that is not love, brother. I didn't express that to him because we don't have that sort of relationship. And she was out literally within, I don't know, 6-7 weeks. She was gone, you know.
Yeah.
But the idea of making yourself vulnerable to such hardship and heartache, because if you think about it, whenever you're under the same roof and you're like living life together, you have sort of that natural emotional bond that's being created, right? Mm-hmm. Well, if you don't have that full-blown commitment till death do us part to ground that, right? And then you end up breaking yourself apart from the other, that's going to create extreme hardship and extreme heartache within the heart, mm-hmm. because you were sort of naturally beginning to give yourself over to the person in this natural attachment, and then you're ripping yourself apart from it. So the cohabitation culture is just setting people up for unhappiness.
And much heartbreak. And I think that that's where I really want to talk here about surrogacy, because at the level of the United Nations, there is a deeper debate surrounding regulation on the issue of surrogacy. And mm-hmm. people are wanting the United Nations to outright condemn it and any policies or organizations that are associated with the United Nations. But the United Nations is kind of staying in that like gray neutral zone of, we'll throw a couple regulations out there, but we're not going to outright say no on surrogacy. And what's interesting is that there's a large number of the feminist movement, and I would say probably more so the feminists that we don't necessarily agree with, people who are pro-abortion, pro-contraception, but in Europe, who absolutely recognize that surrogacy is wrong because it's a form of human trafficking. Mm. And they're looking at the United States and they're saying, wow, like it's actually legal there in the U.S. It's illegal in Europe, and yet we're speaking out against it. But there in the U.S., nothing's really being said. And this is so true. And I want to tell you a brief story, Carlo. A few months ago, I was sitting at a coffee shop, and some of the listeners might have heard this before. It's my sister and I, and I've got my big ears extending out to the sides as I'm eavesdropping. And I hear this woman, and what buzzes is this woman talks about a Catholic hospital close to where I grew up. And I'm listening, and next thing I know, she's looking at this young Asian woman who has an interpreter speaking for her. Long story short, this young Asian woman is being kind of, she's basically in a sales meeting to become a surrogate. She can't understand the language, and there's an interpreter there trying to convince her to be a surrogate. And wow. she's trying to get her to sign away her rights to the child, sign away her rights based on what will and won't be covered in terms of the medical expenses. And I'm sitting here listening to this young woman just being taken advantage of.
Right.
And this is what's happening in our culture. Wombs are being rented out, and yet the conversation about surrogacy is, I know young Catholic women who don't want to get pregnant again, so they're hiring out surrogate moms and they pick up their baby at the hospital.
Right. And as one who studies philosophy, Timory, I think this is an important opportunity to point out how our action will go wherever our intellect, whatever our intellect perceives as good. So the only reason why this activity is being carried out is because people perceive this to be a good thing.
A baby.
A baby to be a good thing. But even the means to achieve the end of a baby, or they are perceiving it, people are perceiving it to be a legitimate, morally permissible means.
Right.
But as a philosopher, we have to take a step back and ask, well, okay, well, is it a morally legitimate means? It's a good intention. You want to have a baby. Fantastic. We agree 100%. It's a legitimate good end or goal that you wish to achieve. But we have to take a step back and ask the question, is the means by which you want to have, by which you want to achieve having a baby, is it morally legitimate or not? Because if it is not, well, then we get back to the fundamental principle of, we can never do evil to bring about a greater good. Can never do evil to bring about a greater good. So if the practice of surrogacy is intrinsically evil and violates the nature of human sexuality, violates thus our rational nature, well, then it's something we ought not to engage in. And thus, it's something that governments ought not to enshrine within law, celebrate, and legalize. Mm. And so it all boils down to those fundamental basic questions. Is this morally right, given our nature as human beings and our nature of human sexuality? or not? And the answer to that question will determine whether or not we can use this means to achieve the end of, I want to have a baby.
And who's suffering in this? Because we know in the American culture that women, it's looked down upon from a woman's perspective to be pregnant, right? It's challenging in the workforce. It gets in the way of work progress, essentially. And so who is the person who is a surrogate in our country? It is the immigrant. It is the person who has come here and maybe doesn't speak the language as well. It is maybe a young person who needs money. And this is where getting into this whole surrogacy issue as well is the issue of egg donors as well. And so we have young women, many young women who are donating, having their eggs harvested so that they can pay off student loans, have some sort of financial gain. It is so common. I mean, all the time I log on to Facebook and dancers who are willing to donate their eggs have healthy eggs. You'll receive top money for your donation of your eggs. But this is detrimental to the body. And so I'm looking at this issue and I just want to make sure we're talking about surrogacy more often, because we have to pay attention to how we are using our bodies, making sure that we're not creating a lie with our body of what we're standing for. And this is where surrogacy, we're lying, we're saying surrogacy is okay because we're not caring about women and the trafficking of women then.
Amen.
Timory will be right back. Tweet them at Timory. That's T-I-M-M-E-R-I-E. You're listening to Trending with Timory, where morality and culture meet, offering an eternal perspective on today's hottest topics.
Have with me in studio today the author of Prepare the Way, Carlo Broussard. Tell me just a little bit, you're from Catholic Answers, about your new book, Prepare the Way.
Yeah, I guess it's still kind of new. It came out late April. So it's Prepare the Way, Overcoming Obstacles to God, the Gospel, and the Church. So I basically coach you, the Catholic, reading the book in strategies on how to help unbelievers and skeptics overcome obstacles to truth, to God, Jesus, Christianity as a religion, and the Catholic Church. So it's step-by-step strategy. Say this, say that. It's sort of a how-to approach. Embedded within the strategies are sort of Socratic questions to help you draw out certain ideas that are embedded in a line of thinking, to sort of expose the flaws of a line of thinking, and to guide the conversation along, and to put you in the driver's seat to direct the conversation in order to lead the person to the conclusion that you want them to lead to. So Prepare the Way obviously comes from the theme of John the Baptist, a voice crying out in the wilderness to prepare a way of the Lord, to lower the mountain or to fill the valley. And so many of the obstacles, it's either the presence of something or it's the absence of something. So it's the presence of evil in the world that keeps somebody from embracing the truth about God's existence. Or it's the absence of something. Namely, I've never encountered a good argument for God's existence. So it's sort of a valley. And so we're called by our Lord to participate in his providence in order to feel that valley, to lower that mountain in order to make a straight path. As our Lord comes bearing the gifts of truth and life to the believer and to the unbeliever and to the skeptic. And it's our job as Christians to, help prepare that way, to remove those obstacles. And that's basically what we do in apologetics, constantly clarifying misconceptions and moving obstacles out the way in order for the Lord to do his thing, right? And it's a great dignity that our blessed Lord bestows upon us. God doesn't need you or me to communicate truth to his people. He didn't need John the Baptist to prepare a way for him, but yet he chose and will to use John the Baptist to prepare a way for his son's coming. And he chooses to use us to prepare a way for his son to enter into the hearts of many. And that's a great dignity bestowed upon us to be able to cooperate in his providential plan to bring about the salvation of souls. And apologetics is an essential means to achieve that end.
And this is so practical because we do live in a society of skeptics, of people who they want to believe, but they don't. They haven't heard a good argument. And we're creating a foundation in a personal way, because the reality is you hear most people talk about their conversions and it's someone always having loved them in a certain way and called them out in fraternal correction or having lived this lifestyle of example, even if it wasn't someone necessarily in close proximity, because they didn't have someone in close proximity, but someone they looked out toward and said, I like what that person has.
Right.
And so I love that, because you, it sounds like you're offering practical ways of actual questions. Ask this question.
Yes.
So that you can go deeper into this person's struggle against the faith.
Right. How can I believe in truth when people believe so many different things, right? Or how can I believe in God when there's so much evil in the world? How can I believe in Jesus when I can't even trust these historical documents that tell us about his life and what he said, namely the gospel? So these are the sorts of questions that I address in my book, Prepare the Way.
And that can be found at CatholicAnswers.com.
Shop.Catholic.com.
Shop.Catholic.com. That's the book, Prepare the Way. We're talking to Carlo Broussard here on Trending. I'm Timory Millington. I want to talk, lots to cover before the end of the show, but don't worry, Carlo will be here on the next episode of Trending as well.
Woo-hoo.
So Kavanaugh, now Supreme Court Justice Kavanaugh, there were all of these accusations. I think the final take was there were three accusations of sexual assault levied against Brett Kavanaugh. Now, one of those, there ended up being a testimony, Dr. Ford, that she came before Congress having her testimony, and he was still voted in. There was no strong evidence to show otherwise, and there have been a number of people who have spoken as a testament to his character that, in fact, we end up finding out this guy was a virgin even past high school and even past college from what we've kind of come to understand. But what's interesting is this week, one of those accusers, Judy Monroe, ended up coming out saying that it's not true. She was angry. She sent off an email and the accusations were just something that were said out of anger because she disagreed with him and she was mad.
Yeah. I think this gives rise to reflection on the importance of being very careful about allegations and applying stringent criteria for assessing the credibility of one's, of somebody's testimony, rather than merely accepting it on face value. I mean, this is a good opportunity to give pause to reflect upon, you know, how we're going to assess testimonies and witnesses and to establish their credibility. And this is something that we must do in all areas of life and of thought, right? I'm not just going to believe any Joe Blow who comes and says, oh, by golly, I saw Mary in a potato chip, right? I mean, we have to assess the credibility of testimony, right? We do that with regard to the testimony of Jesus' resurrection and what Jesus said and did within our Christian faith. We do that. So I think this is a good opportunity to give rise to the reflection on those criteria and how we move forward in that. It also gives rise to reflect upon the principle of one is innocent until proven guilty, right? And Aquinas, actually, St. Thomas Aquinas addresses this principle in the Summa Theologiae in part two of the second part of part two, question 60, article 4. He talks about the importance
crack
of
that summa out, man.
Amen. That when we make a judgment about persons, we can do good or evil to the person we judge, because we honor a person that we perceive to be good and we dishonor people who we perceive to be bad. So we ought to be very careful about our judgments concerning the goodness or the badness of people. In fact, he would go even further to say we can't even judge the culpability and the motives behind the actions of people. We can judge actions, right? But we can't even judge the motives and the credibility of people. So it gives rise to all of these various principles about judging people, right? Mm-hmm. And the principles that guide our acts of judgment concerning actions versus one's culpability for that action. One is innocent until proven guilty, etc. So,
and I think as we talk about this, you have two perspectives. One, I think when someone makes an accusation, we need to trust and believe that person, but walk through the steps to verify.
Amen.
But we don't need to automatically assume that the accused has done what has been done. Now, at the same time, you could be in a parking lot and something happened, right?
Right. You have to make a split decision. You have to, and those circumstantial details prohibit you from assessing the evidence in a systematic you know, patient way. And so you have to act based upon what you have. But whenever you have circumstances where it's not that,
right,
and you have the opportunity to assess the evidence in a patient way before making conclusions, well, then that's the more rational and reasonable approach rather than going based upon emotion, right, and feelings. And as well, I'm sure we'll be talking about, I think, in what episode, the second episode here, sentimentalism and stuff.
Yeah. And we have to emphasize safety. I think safety needs to come first. And so we can make it realistic in terms of the aftermath of the Me Too movement, the current sex abuse scandal within the church, right, among clergy. And again, safety comes first, but we can't automatically assume that the accused is guilty. And that's where we have to go through the proper legal processes,
right,
to make sure that that
comes. And that safety extends to the accused as well. The safety of their good name, right? And their good character and safeguarding their honor, right?
Even if that means removing them from where they're at.
That is correct. That is correct. Because if the allegations are false, and when these allegations are assumed true without sufficient evidence, then grave harm is done to the character, to the good name of that person.
Well, and on a cultural level, let's talk about this practically, because it's very common among teenagers and even young adults to cry wolf. I was raped. I'm upset. I don't like that guy anymore. Or something happened. Or maybe I'm embarrassed because I've had a sexual interaction with someone and I've been found out. So now suddenly I accuse him of having raped me. And that's easier than people thinking that I'm a floozy now.
Right.
We see a lot of this among the young, and it's created an issue, especially for women, that it's like the old story we heard when we were kids of crying wolf. You begin to not be believed. And then again, on the opposite end, people's reputations are just being destroyed, where I see a lot of women who are scared, like, what about my son? Is he going to be accused because some woman is angry, emotionally fired up, regretting the relationship and the sexual interaction, that she's suddenly going to accuse him of having raped her?
Right. Yeah, you bring up a good point. When I think about it, the first thought that comes to me, it's fundamentally a matter of being humble enough, right, to live up to the truth and to live in accord with the truth. The truth is fundamental in all this. You know, if we're not willing to live in accord with the truth in this matter, then who's to say we're going to be willing to live in accord with truth in other matters? But ultimately, we know from the Christian perspective, the truth sets you free, right? Jesus said that in John 8:32. But even from the natural light of human reason, given our nature as rational animals, right? We're human beings. It is good for us to know the truth and to live in accord with that truth. And to lie violates the very order of our rational nature.
And I love that you emphasize truth in this, because it doesn't have to be as extreme as some sort of sexual abuse allegation or experience. But even day to day, we're at a point where we villainize the other person. And even if you're not outwardly expressing like Judy Monroe did, where she said, Brett Kavanaugh raped me and so forth. In fact, she's many years older and didn't even know him, right? That's what's come out. We do this to people we disagree with. Mm-hmm. Even if we don't say it out loud, we often internally make that person into a villain. And so what happens is we're actually sinning as we're doing that. We're creating this resentment, anger, hatred. And that does end up influencing how we gossip or talk of, refer to, or even interact with these people.
That's right.
So while this might be an extreme case with Brett Kavanaugh and his accusers, we have the opportunity to pause and self-reflect. With me has been Carlo Broussard. You can find his work at carlobroussard.com. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Timmery. God bless you.
This has been Trending with Timmery. To learn more about Timmery Millington, visit timmery.com.